Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. Welcome to the Center for Strategic and International Studies. On behalf of our CEO, Dr. John Hamry, I want to welcome you this morning, those in the room. I want to welcome our viewers on the web for joining us as well. We are here to announce that the President and the Republican leadership have agreed on all the details of a grand bargain. The issue has gone away and will reconvene in 2017. We're done, right. Actually, I think that's not true, although they are meeting today, according to the newspapers, and perhaps we'll make progress if progress is defined as the passage of time and the continuing of discussions. I'm David Berto. I'm the director of the International Security Program here. Joining me this morning are two of my colleagues, Clark Murdoch. Dr. Clark Murdoch is a senior advisor and the director of the Defense and National Security Group, and Dr. Maren Lead, who is the senior advisor and associated with the Harold Brown Chair here at CSIS, just back from a vacation on with the U.S. Army for a year. And we want to talk a bit about debt and defense. The way we're going to work this out, first of all, I ask you to silence, if you're in the room, silence your electronic devices. I'm going to leave mine on. If those of you who are watching on the web want to send in comments and questions, you can reach me, dberto@csis.org. Eventually, we'll have a mechanism for doing that, but that's the best we've got right now. Write, but don't call, yes. We're going to each have some conversation this morning, and then we'll open the floor up for questions. We basically just have one slideshow, but it's divided into three sections, and we might... We've been rehearsing for days here, and we may be able to remember when to hand it off and do that. I'm struck by something that I read in the New York Times. Reportedly, Google searches for the name Paul Ryan and the word shirtless has been 9 times the number of the Google searches for the words Paul Ryan and the word budget. And I think that's a reflection of the dynamic today and perhaps a reflection of why we don't really know exactly how this is going to come out. Let me go ahead and go into the first chart, or the next chart, if you will. For I have a clicker. I have to do this myself. Ha, it works. All right. What do we know? We actually only know where these three questions. Where are we? How did we get here? Where are we going? That's what I'm going to cover, and then Clark's going to go into more detail about sort of what the future looks like and some of the other pressures, and Maren will talk a bit about what's actually going on. We all know that the Pentagon is under orders to not even think about planning, so what are they doing that's not thinking about planning? Where are we? We know about 5 facts, all right? Fact number one is sequestration is the law. And absent the passage of a new law that both the House and the Senate agree to and the President signs, sequestration will take effect on January 2nd, 2013. That's a fact. It's undisputable. The second thing we know is that the tax cuts will expire. That's also the law. And absent another law that the President signs on December 31st, a whole slew of tax cuts will expire, and a number of other provisions related to taxes will expire. The third thing we know is that the government is operating under a continuing resolution, and it also expires by law on March 27th, 2013. And the fourth thing we know, although we don't know the exact date, is we know we will hit the debt ceiling, $16.3 trillion, sometime early next year. There's actually a fifth fact, and this is a fact that's for the last several months, actually almost for the past year, has allowed us to ignore the first four. And that was we had an election coming, and we didn't know the outcome of the election. So all discussions were going to wait until the outcome of the election. Well, now, except for a few House races, the election is over, and we know who won. So those are our 5 sort of undisputable facts. Let's look at what that means for defense. This is a picture and of the defense drawdowns of the last 60 years, post-Korea, post-Vietnam, post-Cold War. I don't know what the post is for the last one. Post-Budget Control Act doesn't exactly have the same ring as post-Vietnam. And yet that's kind of where we are. There's a couple of interesting things here. One is that you'll note a fairly consistent pattern of peaks and valleys here, you know, and the variation of peaks and valleys is not all that dramatic until you get to the most recent one. And there we're actually less deep so far than the three previous ones. There are also probably two or three differences of this most recent one that we're in the middle of now and the others. The first is obviously, as I said, we haven't come down nearly as far yet. The second one is that this is the first drawdown of the ones up here that was not triggered by a pretty substantial change in the global security environment. This was much more driven by the financial and economic situation. And unlike the others as well, there's very little on the horizon right now that we can't take care of with the capability we have today. So it makes it more difficult to see what's the triggering event that's going to make it start coming back up. This is the broader situation. On the bottom there, you have defense spending as a percent of GDP, all the way back to 1948, which is the last time it was down around 4% before the mid-90s. And you also see at the top two bars, the red is federal outlays total for all money, and the blue is federal income. And there you see, you know, outlays frequently exceed income, but nowhere on that chart do outlays exceed income to the dimensions they do at the far right for the last 4 years. That's really our problem. It's that 10% gap as a percent of GDP between outlays and income. One of the most interesting things about this is that gap, the gap between outlays and income, was always smaller than the total amount of defense spending until the last 4 years. That was true even during World War II, where we were spending 50% of our GDP on defense. Defense was always more than the deficit until the last 4 years. Now the deficit's actually bigger than defense. For those of us who make a living explaining why we spend money on defense, this is heartening news. We could go to zero and we still wouldn't fix the deficit problem. In fact, that deficit was so large last year and the year before, you could drive 100% of discretionary spending, every federal dollar that's not an entitlement or payment on the debt, and you'd still have a deficit. That's the situation we're in. That's coming down a little bit. Couple points on the continuing resolution. That's what we're operating under now across the government, across the federal government. It was capped at the Budget Control Act level. That actually means a little bit more than what the President's budget had proposed, so there's a little bit of a cushion there for both defense and for non-defense domestic agencies. Didn't address any of the issues, not sequestration, not the fiscal cliff, or what I call the time bombs, or the debt ceiling. Very clean bill, very few anomalies, almost unprecedentedly few, especially for a continuing resolution of this length. Intriguingly, a number of no votes. And the no votes particularly are worth noting. Of the 70 House Republicans who voted against the continuing resolution, all but one voted against it because the spending levels were too high. The Senate Republicans had a more complex reason, but this level of disagreement with essentially a bill just to keep the government running until we figure out what to do was pretty high. And it does expire at the end of March. How did we get here? We got here because of the Budget Control Act, and it's useful to remember the Budget Control Act, which set up ultimately sequestration, is not a spending cut bill. It was a debt ceiling bill, and it raised the debt ceiling in two tranches, an initial tranche of $900 billion in exchange for $900 billion of cuts. That's how DOD got its first line of cuts, the $487 billion over 10 years and $250-something billion in the FYDP. The second tranche would be increased whenever the President was ready, which means when we hit the debt ceiling of the first $900 billion, that took about 5 months, right? So that $900 billion lasted us from August 2nd until January. And it was automatic unless a couple of things happened. The first thing that could have happened is the Super Committee. In fact, we're approaching next Wednesday is the anniversary of the Super Committee announcing that they had reached complete and unanimous agreement that the problem was that the other guys wouldn't play. And that was the only thing they agreed on. Absent action by the supercommittee, it triggered an automatic sequestration of $1.2 trillion, in exchange for which the debt ceiling would go up by $1.5 trillion. Now, that the president made that decision. He announced that Congress had 15 days to pass a resolution of disapproval, which would have prevented the debt ceiling from going up. The House did pass that resolution of disapproval. It did not pass the Senate, so the debt ceiling went up by $1.5 trillion. And that's the reason, that's the basic issue that we had inside the Budget Control Act. You heard, and some of you were here a couple of days ago, you heard a DOD official say that, you know, not a single member of Congress supports this. Well, that was not exactly true when the bill was passed last year. And it's useful for us to remember, although I don't think any of them have this on their website today, proudly proclaiming their voting, that this Budget Control Act passed the House with two-thirds of all Republicans voting in favor and half of the Democrats voting in favor. It passed the Senate with a three-fourths majority. And in part, it was because this was seen as a very useful trap. It would force the Republicans to choose between two things that they hate with equal fervor. Thing number one was cutting defense. Thing number two was raising taxes. And the assumption inside some was that they would ultimately agree to raise taxes instead of cutting defense. Thus far, that's not been the case. There's also a new player in the room, the ratings agencies, Moody's, Fitch's, Standard & Poor's. In all those other drawdowns, those guys were never part of the discussion. They're clearly part of the discussion now. Why? Because we're concerned about them downgrading the debt rating for America. Standard & Poor's actually did downgrade us after the turmoil surrounding the Budget Control Act, down to AA prime with a warning that it was mostly political, it was not economic. The other two agencies did not. They left us at AAA. They have since issued warning notices that we're watching you very closely, but we're still technically at AAA. And there's an interesting thing that happened. You know, the last time we had a technical default, and we didn't actually miss any bills, we didn't not pay anybody, so it was not a real default, and it was only for a couple hours, it was back in 1979 during the Carter administration. And economists subsequently have analyzed this and concluded that we paid, the U.S. government paid, in its interest rates, approximately a 0.5% penalty because of that technical downgrade for 10 years. Now, in those days, 1979, our debt was under $1 trillion, and our annual deficit was running about $40 billion a year, and interest rates were in 12.5% range. So a 0.5% change on 12.5% with just $40 billion a year being borrowed really wasn't all that big a deal. Now a 0.5% change is $500 billion over 10 years. A 1% change is $1 trillion over 10 years. That's the cost of punting, if you will, if we get a downgrade. But you have members who say, well, let's look at this. We have a data point here, right? S&P downgraded us last year. And as a result of that, more people lent us more money at lower interest rates than before. That's a pretty good outcome. Why don't we try that again? Well, that's a bit scary. I mean, any analyst knows that drawing a line from one data point is a bit risky, if you will. And it's pretty clear that there could be a second data point here. There's also, and this doesn't even reflect in any of our charts, an impact on the equity markets. And one of the things that we've seen, I think, over the last week and a half, you know, the stock market is down about 4.5%. Defense stocks are down well over that, about 7% on average. Probably the first day and a half of that reduction was adjustment for the likely or the probability of Romney winning. But by about noon Thursday, all the adjustments in the stock market since then are by and large, concerns over the fiscal cliff and the fiscal situation. So where are we going? Well, as I mentioned, these all expire on December 31st. The defense budget, you can see the blue is the base budget, the red is OCO. On the right-hand side, which is the out years for the next 5 years, you actually have 2013 reflected here as the president's budget, which essentially the CR funded slightly over. You have the purple at the top is the cuts that were already made under that first $900 billion of cuts in the Budget Control Act, DOD's share of that. The green, the top of the green is the BCA caps, and the blue at the bottom is what defense budget would look like under sequestration. This is what it does to the fourth of those four drawdowns. It actually now is still a little above previous years or previous drawdown cycles. I think Clark will probably use this chart again and have some additional comments on it. But now you're down to a cut of 31% from the peak compared to 36, 33, and 43% in the previous drawdowns. So now you're beginning to approach a drawdown that's of historic relevance and equalness. We have a debt ceiling. We don't know when it's going to occur. The Treasury Department has to issue a notice. They usually issue that notice when they know that the next auction has been scheduled that's going to exceed the debt ceiling. They have some flexibility to use monies in ways that delay that debt ceiling, but only by a few weeks or a couple of months. In theory, the debt ceiling will be delayed if the tax cuts expire because we'd be collecting money. But that only occurs if actually the money is collected. As of today, the IRS has not issued new withholding guidance that would, in fact, reflect the expiring tax cuts. Most people don't actually, who write checks for employees, don't actually consult IRS. They use their software, and if the software gets updated, they'll withhold appropriately. If the software doesn't get updated, then they won't. Well, the software is only going to get updated if the IRS changes the withhold guidance, because it's kind of against the law to withhold in a manner that's not consistent with IRS guidelines. So the tax cuts will only help the debt ceiling if, in fact, the guidelines are out there, and right now they're not. There is an impact on sequestration, right? You quit spending money. It saves $109 billion in FY13. But that's only true if, in fact, outlays stop. And as we've heard a number of times, the implementation of a sequestration order will probably be a bit gradual. Nobody's going to stop spending money. No contracts will be canceled the next day. There will be some time. So I don't think we can look to either the tax cut expiration or the implementation of sequestration to delay the arrival of the debt ceiling by much. Let's look at some of the comparative effects. This is just for FY13. This is your $109 billion in cuts from sequestration. The $109 billion, which is the blue, looks a little bit smaller when you look at, in fact, the $400 billion of increased revenue in fiscal 13, which is only 9 months of that fiscal year, from the expiring tax provisions. Those tend to look a little bit smaller when you look at what the deficit would be in FY13 if we fully implement sequestration and all the tax cuts expire. We still have a $650 billion deficit. If they don't expire, we have a $1 trillion deficit, right, which is not trivial. This, however, is the effect of the sequestration over the entire 8-year, 9-year period. This is your $1.2 trillion of sequestration. This is what the impact of the expiring tax cuts are if you don't restore any of them. $6 trillion of revenue. That looks pretty good, right? Except that the publicly held portion of the debt is $15 trillion. In that same period of time. So you don't fix the deficit problem even if you let all the tax cuts expire, not to mention the economic impact that's been talked about of putting us into a recession. And over the long run, you're at $22 trillion of publicly held debt by 2021 compared to about $9 trillion today. The government obviously holds a good chunk of our own debt. So what are we going to do? Well, there's really only three paths forward. We either execute sequestration, we modify sequestration, or we go to the favorite play in the congressional playbook, we punt. Executing sequestration is a bit difficult. We've got some calendar problems. You have probably some time delays here. You can imagine waking up on the morning of January 2nd and discover that the president has signed the execution order. OMB has issued a guidance memorandum. Here's your fair share. Here's how you're going to take it. A lot of details in terms of guidance. Send us your plans. We will review and approve them, and we will let you know when you can begin to implement sequestration. They're going to want to do that because they want to know what it is you've done. And keep in mind, no agency has planned yet, so it may take them a day or two to sort through the OMB guidance and get the plans back in. I take an optimistic review here that you could get the plans in and get OMB approved in a month. All right, and that's not really unreasonable. That month then would be the trigger, early February, for the beginning of implementation. Let's just pick the one area of civilian federal employees. All right, we're not going to riff or fire federal civilian employees in February. As most of you know, the year in which you terminate a federal civilian employee, you don't save money. It actually costs you money for severance pay and paid out accumulated leave and so on. So you're not going to fire people. You're just going to furlough them. It's a requirement that you can't furlough anybody without 60 days notice. So if you get approval in February, you'll send out, if you're really good, you'll have the notices ready to go. They'll go out, and the first furloughs will occur roughly in April. This actually means you're now squeezing up your entire sequestration into half a year, not a full year or even 9 months. So you're probably going to be furloughing civilians roughly once every 6 or 7 days. They'll have a free day off without pay. You can see some impact perhaps on government services from this kind of a situation. And you can see this is going to be a problem. Meanwhile, we have an FY14 budget that's supposed to be submitted on the second week of February. And that budget is based on the assumption that, in fact, there's no sequestration. That probably means it's wrong by $50 billion in the 13 base and by $100 billion in the 14 number. And that extends on out, increasing $50 billion a year for each year in the FYDP. So that's a bit of a problem. And, of course, we have ultimate debt ceiling day occurring in there somewhere. And then at the end of March, the CR expires. So I've got a big red circle around there. This all comes together very, very nicely around next March. You can picture a scenario where you're going to the airport. TSA, because of cuts, only has one screening lane open. So the line at Dulles extends roughly back to Reston. And, the line at National probably might, if we're lucky, extends all the way back to the Capitol. But that's okay because FAA won't have any air traffic controllers, and so there'll only be about 3 or 4 planes taking off every day anyway, so you're in no hurry to get through the line. And one of the things that's interesting to us here is we know a lot about what's going to happen with defense. That's what we're talking about this morning. There is very little out there in terms of what happens to all the other agencies. And if there's any glimmer of hope here, it's that the disaster that will befall those agencies is going to be so dramatic that it might spur some kind of a reaction faster than what will happen to defense. You can modify sequestration. You could say you could apply it flexibly. Instead of every program, project, or activity, give the agencies and departments flexibility in how they achieve their objective. Of course, that raises the question of what are your priorities, who sets them, and how do you reflect them, on what basis do you determine that some people get saved and others get double the hit, and what's the role of Congress in reviewing and approving those priorities? They're not likely to abdicate this and say, you guys can cut that $109 billion wherever you want. We don't care. You know, there's a huge impact, as I mentioned, on 14 all the way out through 21, and the role of Congress in that kind of a flexible thing would be very unclear. Or you could punt. And then the question is, how long, at what price, how long of a punt can you make without Moody's and Fitch's downgrading us? You know, is a month okay? Probably. 2 months? Maybe not. 3 months? 6 months? Do you do a down payment? Do you say, we're going to take 1/9 of that $109 billion in January and we'll punt for 1 month? Or we're going to take 2/9 and we'll punt for 2 months. Now, that probably buys off the ratings agencies. I don't know how you execute that or implement that. So, and then you have to ask yourself, if you're going to get to the end of March, all these things are going to come together here. I call them fiscal time bombs instead of cliffs because if you listen, you can hear them ticking. They're all out there just each day. We're one day closer. Well, the only way that Congress is going to reach some agreement here without a full grand bargain is, in fact, to find another hostage. One of the fears we have is that if you execute sequestration and it's not so bad on the second day or the third day or the fourth day, if you get to February or March and, in fact, there's not a lot of dead people, there's not blood on the floor, you know, the typical appropriator's reaction of, if I cut you and I don't see any bleeding, I must not have cut deep enough, right? And so you can picture a scenario in which Congress gets to March and we're implementing sequestration. It's a little early. Nobody's been furloughed yet. You know, the furlough notices are out there, but nobody's had a day off. No contracts have been terminated, or not very many. No new ones have been signed, but, you know, you're holding out hope that any day now I'll get some new work here. And Congress looks at it and said, well, that's not so bad. Why don't we do that again? Why don't we take another sequestration as a hostage for the deal to have a continuing resolution to finish the fiscal year, to extend the debt ceiling a few more months or another to the end of the year. That, to me, is the scariest scenario of all, the scenario in which Congress says, that's not so bad, let's do it again. So what are we watching for? Well, we're watching to see what happens in the lame duck. We've all been watching to see when does DOD start planning. We're going to talk a little more about that today.
There is certainly, I think, impact from the non-defense discretionary cuts. And with some luck, I think the muzzles have probably been taken off of the agencies who couldn't even talk about it. I mean, only DOD even had a memorandum out that said, don't even think about planning. No other agency even acknowledged that it was something they shouldn't be thinking about. And so this is a kind of a, you know, maybe they can catch up with DOD now. And watch for when that debt ceiling notice comes out, because that allows you to start calculating when the last possible day for reaching some kind of a punt deal will be, because you can't punt beyond the debt ceiling or we have default. You do have people who say, that's okay, let's go over the cliff. And there's really three different groups of these people. There's the left who says going over the cliff is in fact the way to get taxes up to where they ought to be, and so let's do it. There's the right who says, let's go over the cliff because a disaster is the only way in which we're going to get spending under control, so let's go ahead and have it now, right? And then there are a group of people, and a represented friend of mine who I won't quote here today until she says it out loud herself, but she says, every now and then you need a forest fire to clear out the dead wood, you know. And so we all know that there are pockets in defense where you could cut spending and still defend America very, very well. So is sequestration a shortcut to reaching that? It's pretty scary, but those are possibilities. So that's kind of where we are. Let me turn to, and where we might be going, let me turn to Clark Murdoch to create some sunshine and happiness in the equation here.
But I've always been quite amazed at how much humor and sarcasm you can do on this very grim subject.
It's the only way I can stand to do it.
My first chart is the one that you've seen before, but with a couple of, I want to make one comment and one addition. You'll note that on this buildup, it was true during the Cold War to some extent, but really true during the post 9/11 buildup, that it wasn't an active duty personnel. It was in dollars. And those dollars paid for lots more civilians, lots more contractors, and the active duty hours of the reserve components. So that you can expect to see, as we do the drawdown, it being felt in those three categories as well, because that's where the buildup was. One of the reasons is that during the last decade, as several have pointed out, is that the personnel costs for uniformed military have gone up 60%. So one of the reasons didn't build up an active duty personnel is just getting too expensive, and you got more people for the contractors and more reserve component at that time. The second thing that I wanted to point out is that in the previous three drawdowns, we went back to a level of about $400 billion in FY13 dollars. These are constant dollars throughout. Now we're down to about $520 billion. What that represents is the effect of internal cost inflation inside the Pentagon. So that we have a, as Todd Harrison at CBS has pointed out, we had hollow growth during the post 9/11 buildup. Generally the same force structure. It just cost us a lot more to pay for it. I like this slide because it demonstrates the extent of a point that David made before, is that because of the magnitude of the crisis, that abolishing defense spending or even abolishing all discretionary spending doesn't solve the problem. We made a fairly optimistic projection of 3.1% increase in the federal budget over time. And what it shows here is that interest spending plus what are known as entitlements, crowd out all discretionary spending in sort of the mid-2030s during that time. And that means that this problem that we're facing today, this fiscal cliff, is going to be one of many fiscal cliffs over the next couple of decades. We're going to be here again and again and again, because it's hard for me to see the kind of bargain that does more than push this a little bit to the right and actually solves the problem, because this reflects demographics. It's baby boomers retiring. that's unchanged benefit levels, and it just happens. In the next slide, we turn again to the defense. This is against the projected top line. Our top line for this is essentially the BCA caps plus the sequester cuts. Our assumption or our belief is that even as part of a near-term grand bargain, you are going to have defense cuts in it anyway, because that represents defense constitutes about 55% of discretionary spending. The military personnel and the, it's hard to tell the color, military care, they look sort of constant, but they reflect also a drawdown in personnel level. That is that you had active duty reserve components that are in there that are coming out, and you also had the 80,000 personnel cut in the Army that's projected to go out through 2017, and the personnel cut of the Marines of about 20,000. So while those look constant, there are fewer and fewer people in there. The O&M is also ratcheted down because we sort of use an O&M per person as our calculation figure, but because of cost inflation, it continues to go up, and we have the acquisition cost growth. But the point here is that for the Defense Department, unless you do something to address the internal cost growth problem, by FY21, which is when all of the top-down sequester cuts are supposed to end, there's no money for acquisition. It's the Norm Augustine problem in reverse. Instead of having just one incredibly complex system that is extremely expensive, we now have people, but without equipment. So what did we do? As the beginning of trying to look at how you solve the problem, is that we said, okay, the trade space here, essentially, is you have a zero-sum trade-off between people and dollars for acquisition. The, quote, normal, unquote, level of acquisition spending, modernization spending, which is RDT&E plus procurement, is about 32% of the budget. It was that pre-9/11. It was that at the peak of the buildup in 2010. And so we went out to 2021 and said, okay, we want 32% of the budget. I've been a maven of the Pentagon my whole professional career. I've led many studies on defense. Had a previous study on Beyond Goldwater Nichols. Dave Oliver, who's in the audience, was a member of that, and he once got up and declaimed, the only thing that works is a Secretary of Defense with strong intestinal fortitude. I substitute in there. He's right. That's the only thing that works. That and one other thing, hard spending caps. That's an appropriator's tool. You fence dollars for things that you want to procure, and you protect those dollars, or you put hard spending caps on the things you don't want to spend dollars on, and you enforce those. So our approach here is, first of all, fence your modernization dollars to protect them from encroachment. And then, as you go to the last slide that I'll talk to, but not in great detail, because we're still in the process of working it, is that when you look at how much defense you're getting out in 2021, you've got about a 20% reduction due to top-line decreases that we've been talking about. You have a 24% reduction because of internal cost inflation. That's the aggregate impact of all of these inflationary rates of acquisition, inflationary rates with O&M. And so you end up with a budget in real terms that is 56% of our 2012 budget. We're in the process of translating that into what does that mean in terms of capability that you'll have out in 2021. Institutional support, and we've gotten decades-long information on that, it's about 32% of the budget, that is the organized, train, and equip. It's not useless overhead. It's what you have to spend dollars on in order to provide capabilities, in order to recruit people, in order to train people. Now, is there waste in there? For sure. That's why, instead of giving 32%, which is historically what it's looked like, we give 30%. So 30% of your future force is going to be for institutional support. And then what we're going to do is say 35% of it's going to be completely threat-driven. It's going to be some capability to deal with counterterrorism, some capability to deal with homeland defense, some capability in terms of a nuclear deterrent, some capability in terms of power projection. How much capability? All you can afford for 35% of your budget. Not necessarily enough, but all you can afford. And then what we're going to use as a concept for strategy options is the notion of discretionary defense spending for DOD. That is, dollars that you can spend to perhaps double down and get more common core capabilities, or you can do the 2012 strategic guidance, which is Asia-Pacific emphasis, still stay in the Middle East, of course, and maybe come down a little bit in Europe, but still a rebalancing for 2012. Or you can do Andy Krepinevich's new strategy of assured access. And the Stimson Center came out with a new strategy, which I haven't read yet, but which is probably a lot less of everything. The point here is that the first drill in trying to close the gap between our ends and means is to be realistic about if these are the dollars and the number of people you have available, this is all the capability you get. And so we may talk about an assured access strategy. That doesn't mean we have the capability for it. Because again, I said, this is further work. And while I don't have a title slide, I do know that's my last slide. Over to Mark.
All right, well, I guess it falls to me to try to cheer everybody up. I'm pretty certain I'll fail in that, so let me just state from the beginning. I don't think it gets better from here. I'm going to talk a little bit more at the tactical level about what's going on inside the department and sort of the mechanics of getting from here to there and of the next 9 months, both with the sequester scenario and also what might happen in the event of some sort of a deal. As David mentioned, the guidance remains not to plan. I think one of the reasons OMB and DOD specifically issued guidance telling DOD not to plan is telling them not to plan is like telling them not to breathe. So while they are not planning, they are thinking, assessing, evaluating. But the practical implication of the don't plan guidance means that they are not able to do so in any kind of shared any kind of fashion that facilitates shared understanding. So there's a lot of people making a lot of assumptions within stovepipes, and they're doing it at very high levels but unable to clarify for lower echelons. And so there's a huge amount of ambiguity out there that means it's really hard to think through how you would actually pull this off without some greater clarification, greater specificity. I'm going to talk through first what this means, what taking the sequester cuts would mean in 13, but this by no means suggests that it gets any easier in 14 and out, so I'm going to just spend a little bit of time at the end. This is just a basic depiction of the overall defense budget, both base and contingency operations, or OCO. On the right, at the continuing resolution level, it's about $620 billion. If you exempt military personnel spending, there's about $145 billion of that in both the base and OCO accounts. That gets you down in the 580-ish range. Then you add back in on obligated balances, which is approximately 90 to 100 billion. We've assumed 100 here. And then there's about 25 billion in other 050 spending in DOE and elsewhere. So against that total base, to get to the 54.7 billion that's required for DOD, that would take the DOD budget down to about 523 billion. And that's what it looks like by appropriation. That results in about a 9.1% cut. That's a little bit lower than what OMB estimated. What this chart is intended to show, and I apologize, it's a little bit busy, and I don't know how well the sort of polka-dotted colors show up on here, but what I was intending to try to show here is part of the story here is where the OCO spending is, because the department has testified that they intend to try to protect that to the greatest possible extent. And so the ultimate result of that is that you end up taking deeper reductions in the base budget than you would. So the 9.1% is the overall defense, but if you protect OCO, the base budget gets cut by about 10.4%. And the most dramatic effects are for, not surprisingly, the operation and maintenance accounts, because that's where most of the OCO spending is. There's a little bit in procurement, and there's much less in the others. But by department, the Army's the hardest hit by OCO protection policy. Again, I don't think anybody believes that they'd actually protect all of it, but that's their current claim. Whether it's 90%, 95%, 100%, they're probably going to protect a significant chunk of it. This chart takes the OCO piece out of it and just looks by department at what the base budget looks like. The left-hand column in each is the FY13 budget request. As David mentioned, the continuing resolution actually meant an increase in the overall DOD top line. Most of that in the Army was in military personnel accounts, and so they actually saw a little bit of a decline in the other accounts for their overall CR level. It went up for the Department of Navy. It went up for the Department of the Air Force. And sort of the story of this chart, there are a couple things I want to talk through, but one of them is at the macro level, it looks like by appropriation, the departments are not that bad off relative to their FY13 budget request. There's a little bit of devil in the details, interestingly enough, in part because of changes between the 12 and 13 budget requests. All of the services took fairly significant reductions in MILCON. The effect of the continuing resolution was that those MILCON numbers were increased. So under sequester, even under sequester, in every department, military construction spending actually goes up from the 13 budget requests, not down. For procurement for the investment accounts, the Army ends up taking a little over $1 billion under sequester of a reduction from their 13 budget request, about $500 million in procurement, about $600 million in RDT&E. Department of the Navy actually is about a wash, about $200 million out of procurement and about that same amount back in RDT&E. And the Air Force ends up about $1.6 billion to the positive in investment accounts, the overwhelming majority of that in procurement. The big impact here, again, as I mentioned on the previous chart, is in O&M, cuts to the O&M base, in particular for the Army and also for the Navy and to a lesser degree for the Air Force. It's about, I think, over $8 billion out of base O&M for the Army. That's about a 15% cut, a little bit more, I think, in base O&M. It's about a $6.5 billion cut for Navy O&M. Base O&M, and it's an over $2 billion cut for the Air Force. So what does this all mean when you try to work through the mechanics? Again, the absence of guidance means people don't really, there's no shared understanding of how much flexibility there will be in determining what a program, project, or activity means. While I think there's some consensus between Congress and OMB that PPA means the R1, P1 levels in the RDT&E and procurement accounts. That is not widely known or necessarily believed within the department. The O&M question is even more ambiguous. At what level of O&M will the reductions be applied? Another big question about how much transfer authority there will be, and that's a huge component of this because, again, some of the mismatches that we looked at on the previous slide, if you've got extra money in MILCON, you'd really like to spend somewhere else. There's a lot of money to be moved around, and if they're unable to do that, that's a big deal. There's a timing issue. And if they have a month, as David hypothesized, to get their executions plans back, to OMB, again, while they are planning, there's a lot of different potential scenarios depending on where these things where the PPA levels get set, and again, transfer authority and other things, there's slightly different approaches being considered within the departments, again, without coordination or guidance that I think there's both a sort of a bottom-up approach will give the program managers their cuts and let them figure out how to take them. And then there's I think the Marine Corps is looking at more of a centralized approach where they try to balance across, and probably easier for them given their size to do more of a top-down method. But, again, it gets a little dicey when you start thinking through, are you going to direct things? Is there going to be top-down direction to protect certain types of things? And are the types of things that you would want to protect at less than the 10.4% ratio? Is there a shared understanding of what those things are within the military departments and with OSD and with OMB and with Congress? And if you think about it in the context of just operation and maintenance, for example, I mean, do you tell base commanders you can't touch family support activities? Do you tell base commanders you can't touch family support activities at places where there are deployed units, but other bases can take them? You inevitably, if this execution goes forward, there is no way that you are not going to have second, third, fourth, fifth order effects where that'll range from, I don't want to mischaracterize this, but relatively minor in the sense of a sailor at one installation has an entirely different level of services than one at another, to if you've got there's a lot of joint interdependencies built into this, and so you know that's always a place where the services would like to look first, and some of those things aren't going to get caught, and they're going to realize, oh, you know, the Air Force decided to cut all of their snow clearing support at Elmendorf or some shared base, and the Army didn't, and so you know some parts of family housing are getting plowed and some are not, and so those kinds of things, but you're also going to have more significant disputes, and do you protect working capital funds and revolving funds so that they're going to have a huge amount of uncertainty in trying to understand what their workload's going to look like. Again, if you mandate that those kinds of activities are going to continue to be funded, where else are you going to offset that? The training implications are totally unknown. Who's going to have, do you cut everybody's flying hours or tank miles or something else by the same amount, or do you have to take a more nuanced approach? And again, sort of, we're going to screw this up over and over again in some ways that matter a lot and in some ways that matter less, but it's going to be, I think, very public and a drumbeat of failures if this goes forward. To varying degrees. I mean, I was thinking yesterday about this F-22 that crashed. It's possible that if that happened in a post-sequestration environment, you know, there's going to be investigations, and did sequestration contribute to this? And I mean, it's going to be over and over again, those kinds of things. So this whole, how does it all work? It's kind of mind-boggling to think through, and it really is a mechanical train wreck. This, of course, all has to get sorted out early in the year, and at the same time, as David mentioned, 14 doesn't wait, right? And you've also got to make those decisions about 13, in theory, not knowing, and you almost certainly won't know it at the lower levels, what's going to happen in 14. So how you make reasonably intelligent projections about what you can afford to not do in 13, given that you don't know what the hell is going to happen in 14, excuse my French, is no mean feat. But the department has stated from, I think, the beginning of its issuance of the last strategy document that it would have to be revisited in light of future cuts, sequestration or otherwise, and I think they acknowledge that it could probably withstand about another $100 billion over the next 10 years. You could still do it. A key part of that is if the department sees some future level of cuts between sequestration and $100 billion or so, is it taken all on the base? Is some of it taken in OCO? That matters a great deal given the interplay between what's happened in those two funding streams. If the strategy remains, I think there's questions about exactly how much anti-access area denial do we need. Do we need the full set of capabilities that's presently associated with it? Do we need it to the same degree? How much redundancy, et cetera, et cetera. The obvious touchstone in any of these conversations is end strength. Both the Army and the Marine Corps were pretty adamant about more about the ramp, the pace at which people came out of the force than they were about the absolute number. The only way you get to significant numbers is if you take them, significant funding is if you take them out early. So there's going to be huge pressure on increasing the slope of that ramp, and that's going to be, I think, a major debate. All of the things up here on this list are being thought about because there hasn't been guidance not to think about these things. but they're all thinking about them in their corners and very secretly, of course. And then, obviously, the active reserve tensions, which we saw to some degree last year, will certainly get exacerbated. The services are all essentially at progressive readiness models now. Do we go to tiered readiness for whom? And again, how does that play in an active and reserve context? There's the question of what I call right-sizing the insatiables. How do you think about how much intelligence we need? How much cyber do we need? How much space do we need? How much special operations do we need when there's never enough? Clearly the pay and benefits questions are going to be right back on the table. There's some budgetary. That's just complicated, as we're all well aware. And then there's the programs, the big programs. So they've got to think all of this through, at least to some extent, enough to get through a 14 budget with a certain reduction of something, but they don't know what yet. And then I'd be shocked if they can get themselves to submitting a FYDP. So as soon as they finish that budget, they'll be right into figuring out the out years or trying to work through the out years. So it's going to be a bloody, bloody year. I mean, to the extent there's a silver lining in sequestration, the knives don't come out until this discussion starts happening because everybody has to do it equally. Come springtime, I think it's going to get pretty ugly, and it's going to last through the end of the year. So that's my happy conclusion, and let's open it up to discussion.
Let me put a bright, sunshiny wrap up to this. We do know the way out of this mess. Right, we came very close to it in July of 2011 before the Budget Control Act was signed. We came close to it again with the Supercommittee. We didn't cross the bridge either of those times, but we can see the bridge and we know its dimensions from a political point of view. It is what we euphemistically call the grand bargain. And that grand bargain has a number of shapes. Simpson-Bowles has one reflection of it. Rivlin-Domenici has a second one. The discussions that are reflected in many of the popular novels and news media reports of the negotiations between the president and the House Republicans reflect a third version of it. But essentially, it has the following elements. It has an element of saving money through reform of entitlements, reducing expenditures for Medicare, Social Security, et cetera. Roughly in the grand bargain scenario, that's $1 trillion in reduced expenditures over the next decade. And, of course, that reduction extends out and eats into David Walker's $53 trillion of unfunded liabilities that we have over the long haul. The second is $1 trillion of increased revenue, usually coming from some type of tax reform, closing loopholes. Now, we all know that that's easier said than arithmetically done, but that's kind of the equation. The third is actually $1 trillion in reduced spending, domestic discretionary and defense spending over that same decade time period. And if you do those three things, if you have some combination of increased revenue and reduced expenditures that totals $3 trillion, you actually reduce the projected payment on the debt by another trillion. That's your $4 trillion grand bargain. Some of us suspect that if you actually had a secret ballot vote in the U.S. House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate tomorrow,
well, they're not in session tomorrow, but assuming when they get back from Thanksgiving for the second half of the lame duck, that bargain would pass. Now, the details are non-trivial, and they have to be worked out. But it's a lot easier to work out the details if, in fact, you've got the legislative structure, and particularly if you do it in a budget resolution scenario where you have reconciliation and it only takes 51 votes to get through the Senate. You can actually see this working. And I think if you had a secret ballot vote, it would happen today. The problem is we're not going to have a secret ballot vote. And therefore, there are right now, in fact, the House actually voted on this last year. There were 37 votes out of 435 members in favor of the grand bargain. 37 people who went on the record. I haven't checked to see how many of those people are coming back in the 113th Congress, but I know it's not all of them, right? Because that's what the politics mitigate against. So we do know the way out, but there's no path to get to that way out right now. So with that, we're going to open the floor up to questions. Let me remind you sort of how we do the questions in the room here. You raise your hand, we'll recognize you. One of the staff will bring you a microphone. You speak into the mic and tell us who you are and who you represent, and then ask your question. If you want to ask a question of one particular person up here, you can direct it to that person. If you want to leave it up to us as to who is brave enough to try to answer it, then one of us will volunteer, almost certainly. If you're watching on the web, you can email me your questions at dbertaub, D-B-E-R-T-E-A-U, at csis.org. And we'll read them, and if we can make sense out of them, we'll ask them as well. So with that, questions in the room first. Let's see a show of hands. Why don't we start at the back on the left there, and then we'll come up here.
Hi, Rich McFarland from Parsons. Excuse my voice. From what I understand, we may have part to put some glimmer of hope on this, if I may. Not a lot. Okay. The IRS actually has to lock the tables the first week of December. So with that being the case, part of the negotiation, I would think, is, at least in terms of tax structure, is probably, if I'm thinking logically, excuse me, that for 13, the tax structure is set. And so everything that would go, any grand bargain that would be in play would be active from 14, from at least a tax structure standpoint, would be active or implemented from 14 on out. Do you all see that as a scenario or any credibility behind those thoughts?
I'm not familiar with the IRS's internal procedures. I would operate under the assumption that in the event the president reaches an agreement, you can work backwards and reflect it into 13 to some extent as well. I do think that one of the political dynamics that to me was a cause for optimism was that if the tax cuts do expire, and of course what would be likely to happen is they'd expire on December 31st when the 113th Congress is sworn in on January 3rd, they would have waiting for them a legislative proposal from the president, similar to the one that he's talking about now, to restore those tax cuts for 98% of Americans and just keep them for the wealthy. And that so when Americans, 140 million Americans, get their first pay stub in January and it had 10% less money in it, they would be, not surprisingly, unhappy. And they would say, who do I blame for this? And the president would say, well, not me. Congress has got my bill. All they have to do is pass it, and you get your money back, right? If, however, and so to me, 140 million Americans mad is much bigger than any impact of sequestration, right? Because even if you're waiting in line at TSA, I mean, somebody said, you know, even if the agencies all have to take an 8% cut, how will you tell the difference? You know, I mean, it's they're all so badly run anyway. It's not, you know. I mean, that's a witticism, but it is likely not to take an immediate effect so that you'd see it. But I tell you, 140 million people with that pay stub, with Uncle Sam having kept a lot more of their money, that's immediate and that's real. If the guidelines for withholding don't reflect that, you lose that political pressure for that 140 million Americans, and you take a lot of the pressure off the table for Congress to do something, not punt, you know. And that's, to me, a greater concern out of the IRS locking up than it is whether or not you could ultimately have some resolution of FY13 revenue there. In the front here, I think.
I'm Harlan Ullman. First, thanks for a really terrific panel. It was witty and I think a great substance. And I think it's best case. Because I'd like you to comment on a couple of things that are also important here. Not on your list, Dave, was Dodd-Frank and the fact that it's only a third written and what the SEC and FDIC are going to do. And the prospect, supposing we do have a recession, and instead of having positive GNP, it goes down, and that takes into account the euro, which I think is not out of the question. Second, in terms of people, not only are we getting out of Afghanistan, but I think we have a crisis of morale in our senior officer ranks right now, which is seen by Petraeus and a lot of these witch hunts. It was told to me, and I can't confirm, that there are over 100 investigations of generals and 100 investigations of admirals by IGs. And, you know, you're guilty until proven innocent. So we're going to have a real morale problem, I suspect, in the senior flag ranks. Thirdly, we have nobody in the Department of Defense or in Congress who's ever done any downsizing. So how do you deal with that? And, for example, when you're going to have a decline in numbers, what happens when an F-35 costs $500 billion? How do we deal with all those things?
I note, Harlan, that you didn't direct that question to Clark or Marin, so I'll take a first crack and give them a little time to think about it as well. Right. No, I mean, I think all of your points are valid. You know, the strength of one of the real strengths of DOD, and it's been true for 50 years now, is its ability to do integrated, fiscally disciplined, long-term planning. We call it the FYDP, the Future Year Defense Program. But it doesn't matter what you call it. It's a way of balancing requirements and strategy and resources in a way that almost no other agency even comes close to. And it's not only at the top line level for the whole department, but for the components as well. We have lost, I think, over the last decade, a lot of that capability, independent of downturn experience or not, simply because supplementals and overseas contingency operations account gave you a safety valve. Whenever you had a problem, you just paid for it out of OCO. And so we really need to rebuild that capability. Nothing in this dynamic that we've described today fosters that. In fact, it undermines it. So I think the process by which we execute could have as much in way of long-term consequences as the results themselves in terms of dollars. You can see it even, for instance, Maren mentioned uncertainty with respect to implementation of sequestration in the O&M accounts. Now, if you go back to what the Deputy Secretary of Defense, Ash Carter, and the Director of OMB, Jeff Zients, said in their testimony back on August 1st before the House Armed Services Committee, they made it clear. They said we're going to treat O&M as a single account that will allow us to protect OCO. So other parts of O&M will take more. And it sounds like clear guidance, right? And yet, as we see inside the department, nobody inside the department is interpreting that as definitive guidance for two reasons. One is, we'll believe it's clear guidance when we actually get the document from OMB that says what it is, not testimony before the Hill. The second is, we're not sure we like that guidance, and so we might want to do it differently, and we want to reserve the option to think about it differently and propose that in our package, if you will. So I think there's an additional problem, which is, as Maren points out, the lack of any integrated approach to all of this, which could create even more chaos. The problem is you won't see all that right away. You won't see all that on January 3rd, or even February 3rd, or even March 3rd. It'll be a long time before you see those consequences. So up at the top, the water's going to look fairly smooth, while down below, there's a lot of buffeting and to-ing and fro-ing. I don't really have an answer to how you deal with that, other than to make it clear what it is you're doing and what the consequences are at the time you implement. Don't hide from the facts. And I don't know any guidance that's going out that says don't hide from the facts.
Let me address briefly your second and third points about the morale problem and the lack of experience in the downsizing business. I guess I'm less concerned about the morale problem. I think there is, while I agree that there's been a low level of chatter for some time about investigations and against not only senior officers, but just in general, I mean, the number of investigations relative to the war is just phenomenal, and I think that there has been a concern about that, the magnitude of that, the careers that have the effect of that on careers, and whether or not we have that balance right within the uniform ranks for a while. My particular view is of the senior officer issue is it's obviously, you know, topic of the day, but I'm not sure that it's a systemic problem. And I actually think there's some number of senior officers who view this as an opportunity to sort of get back to having more discussions among themselves about their behavior and their let me just leave it at that. But I am not as acutely concerned about that. The downsizing issue, I think I also have a slightly optimistic I won't say optimistic, but I would say less pessimistic perhaps than yours. There are, in fact, a fair number of people who have done downsizings before in the department. They're civilians. They all may be furloughed, but there's a lot of people who've been there for decades. I mean, that's one of the problems the department has, right, is how senior their civilian workforce is and how many retirement-eligible folks they have. Now, unfortunately, a significant number of that experience has walked out the door in the last couple of years, but there's still a lot of people around who have done this more than once. And so the real question in my mind is whether the politicals and the military, who have not typically, let them play a more significant role. And that, to me, is an open question.
Just a quick point on the last point. I think, actually, people within the building have had a bit more experience on making decisions in an atmosphere of scarcity than we think. They've been dealing with the internal inflation issue for some time. The way they did the 9/11 buildup reflects the fact that they're dealing with the increasing scarcity of uniformed personnel to conduct operations. So they threw dollars at it and bought contractors, greatly changed the ratio in operational matters. Now they're having to go back to doing more inherently governmental functions wearing a uniform. And the issue is every year, you know, and I think it's gotten worse each year, the execution year starts with a lot of broken glass on the floor, and they're trying to make do of how do we pull a coherent program out of all of these broken programs in terms of funding profiles. So I think there actually has been more experience on this. What there hasn't been is the kind of tough decisions that you make up front to prevent this annual or quarterly scrambling to try to make your dollars fit, stretch.
Hi, Jen DiMasio from Aviation Week. Even if your best case scenario happens and there's a grand bargain, defense is likely to face additional cuts in that scenario. Your slide mentioned, you know, put some programs on the table that would be in consideration. But what are those realistically? Is the department more likely to delay programs and cut them and slow them down, or are we in for another round of program kills?
Thank you, Jen. Let me start. You're absolutely right. I mean, it's pretty obvious from whatever kind of the nature of a grand bargain. There is no scenario in which we reach agreement to cut entitlements, increase revenue, cut domestic discretionary spending, in which the Defense Department doesn't also have significant reductions. I mean, the votes just aren't there for that kind of an agreement. And so under any escape from sequestration, you're likely to end up with a minimum, I think, of $30 to $40 billion a year coming out of defense. Now, the benefit to that, though, could be that it's not all right now. In other words, the way the Budget Control Act has it, it's the biggest number is in 13, and then it's a slightly declining number each year after that. The kind of scenario that Clark lays out, where we've got some tough issues we have to resolve, including questions of what priorities, what programs would you keep, which ones would you let slide, those will take a while. You really, I don't think, would see the net effect of that, even if you don't change your strategy, until you put the FY16 to 21 FYDP together. And that, you know, the guidance for that will go out 15 months from now.
So really, you take that 15 months between, let's say we reach a grand bargain today. Politico says we're meeting today, so we must be close. So you use that 15 months to wrestle with the questions that you've laid out there. You don't have 10 years to figure this out. You've got 15 months. The fiscal guidance that goes out for that FY16 FYTP is essentially going to be wrestled with by early 2014. And so you've got about that amount of time. If you, in fact, take more of the defense cuts later, then you can accommodate that in your thinking and planning. And that offsets a number of Harlan's concerns, and it allows you to deal with the issues that Clark raises. That's the when you said my most optimistic scenario, I was really struggling to know what the heck that might have been. But obviously that is the most optimistic scenario. And it's one where defense can plan for its cuts, execute and implement its cuts, and, in fact, look at the consequences for capability as part of that process.
Just add a short comment on that. For structure cuts, I mean, there's only two ways that you really get bankable savings. One is you stop paying people to do things and let them go and put the money that you would program to spend on that into a bank. Or you cut money that had been allocated for a particular acquisition thing and you put that money in the bank. It's not by saying, well, we're not going to spend OCO money that we haven't programmed yet to spend. That's a gimmick. Or we're going to get all of our tax savings out of economic growth that we think is going to happen once we act responsibly. You know, those are fictional savings at that point. One of the problems is that when you look at force structure cuts, there's a trade-off between treating people decently and the amount of money you save. The thing about the sequester cuts, as you pointed out, sudden, dramatic, but you do them right up front so you get the savings across the whole FYTP. And if you make the sequester cuts the way the sequester cuts are mandated in law, you actually end up with a top line out in FY21 that's about $30 billion higher, so that you have fewer acquisition cuts that you have to make during that time. Because it's the cutting of people that really save you money. And it saves you the most money if you do it quickly and dramatically, but that's not a good way to treat high-quality people in an all-volunteer force.
Thanks. Mike Seifert from Honeywell. Let's assume for a moment that a grand bargain is reached and Congress all high-fives each other and declares victory. As I see it, though, that doesn't solve the problem. As you look out over, you know, it'll take at least probably a decade to get to a balanced budget, assuming you could even do it at that point. It doesn't do anything to the debt that's still increasing over that decade. Also, over the next decade, you have to probably assume that interest rates aren't going to go much lower and may come up a little bit, and you've already talked about the implications of that happening. So I'd like your thoughts on, you know, if you get a grand bargain and everybody thinks they're done, that doesn't solve really the long-term issue as I see it. And so what do you do from there when the public, I think, is under the impression that if they do this, problem goes away, but it really doesn't?
Mike, you're right. Even as enormous as a $4 trillion grand bargain sounds over 10 years, it buys you time, is what it does. It buys you time to figure out other ways forward. All the demographics, all the economics still come into play there. And we do face not only a debt that continues to rise. I mean, the $4 trillion grand bargain doesn't get you a balanced budget, right? Not for 1 year, certainly not for 10 years. It takes the political pressure off, and that's likely to take any motivation to do anything about it in the near term. My suspicion is that that's the kind of thing that will perhaps come back to bear in the 2016 presidential election. And think tanks will be thinking hard about what the options are in the 4 years in between in that regard. you know, we tend to only look at defense and what's going to happen in DOD, and I think that's hard enough under a grand bargain scenario. I'm pretty sure that a $500 billion reduction in DOD over the next 10 years is about as big a bite as we can manage and still figure things out. But if we can, in fact, figure out how to defend America for less than that, that'll be defense's contribution to the longer term. I don't see anybody doing anything about it for the next 4 or 5 years, though, even if we buy this. That we're going to swallow this pill and say, okay, we're not taking any more medicine for quite a while to come. So, do you guys disagree with that?
No, I don't. I just add that as you rightly pointed out, it doesn't do anything about the problems that Clark raised, right? It doesn't matter how much you take down that top line, you still have that growth from inside. And the appetite for dealing with that is pretty limited. So it's going to get a lot harder. This is, as you point out, the first step to something that doesn't get any easier.
But you probably don't. You can't punt that one for 5 years.
Right.
You have to deal with the declining value of the defense dollar sooner than 5 years, I think, is your message, loud and clear. Across the hall there? It's not a hall.
Wayne Schroeder, question for both Clark Murdoch and Marin Lead. You both discussed the force structure issue. And as you know, the administration's plans show the Army around 490 in 17, and the Marines, I think, around 180, 182. Could you talk to the pressure that you see on the general force structure in more specific terms of where those numbers may go, where they might be in 17, where they might be in 22? And then also, Marin, I think you also raised the OCO question. Could you talk about where you see the OCO going after we end our combat role in Afghanistan?
Well, I mean, I want to first make the distinction between end strength and force structure. And one of the things I think that's notable about the reductions that have already been agreed to in end strength is they haven't been tied to reductions in force structure. So the structures, what they're doing is manning the existing structure more robustly and in a way that increases readiness. But they haven't taken a lot of structure out. Now, the structure cuts are coming for the Army. It'll be interesting to see. Once they unveil those in the 14 budget, what the congressional response is, and they're exacerbated by the Army's plans to reorganize a bit. But that, you know, there are a couple different options. If Army and they're mostly at the margins, this trade between you take more in strength. One of the things again the Marine Corps did with some of their increased was to increase manning levels in units. If they have to take more structure out, do they go back down to 90% levels, or do they take structure out to make sure that they can maintain their higher manning levels within their structure? That works for smaller cuts. It doesn't work when the numbers get bigger. I think it's related to Jen's question also, how quickly the people come out it's a delicate balance between the big acquisition programs and the people because their funding profiles are different and taking more people out relieves the pressure on the investment accounts. Going after some of the investment accounts may allow you some more time to go after the people. But I think also so where do I see that going? I think there's widespread expectation that additional cuts to the Defense Department of any magnitude would first and foremost mean reductions in end strength, principally in the Army and to some degree in the Marine Corps. Whether the other services are exempt from that or to the degree to which they will also be caught up in it, I think, is TBD, but I think the Army's the big target. It will then, I think, turn into discussion between active and reserve. Again, in the last round of cuts, the Army made extremely modest reductions to the reserve components, and they've said, General Odierno has said, that cannot continue to be the case if more reductions are required. That didn't go so well for the Air Force. I think that turns into something extremely difficult and and messy. How low can they go? You know, they can go as low as you want them to go, or as low as the country decides they need to go relative to other priorities. I think the ultimate General Odierno's position, and I will say that because I was recently working for him, but his position has been he would rather maintain balance across investment readiness and manning accounts than protect end strength at any cost. And I think the commandant has the same view. So, but there's going to be some tough trades. I mean, the Army doesn't have a lot of big acquisition programs to go after, and whether they'd be willing to give up their readiness model for something different or adjust it is another question too. So, I don't have a very good answer other than it's gonna not be pretty. But they are the big target, and I think it's inevitable that'll be the first place people go.
We have about 10 minutes left. What I'd like to do, I'm going to ask Arno to ask a question here. I've got a couple of questions on the web that I want to get to, and then we'll see if we've got time for one final one from there. Arno?
Borgram, CSIS. Doesn't this rather grim picture so cogently explained here this morning militate in favor of major reductions in overseas commitments?
You want to take that first?
Sure. Yes. Now, clearly, we're at a stage where we're going to have to follow, because of the fiscal pressures, what I call a cost-capped approach. There, you just simply do not have access to the extra money that we're used to. And what we're trying to do in my particular area of work is to say, if you've got this amount of resources in terms of people, and in terms of acquisition dollars, because that's what you need to have to produce military capabilities, this is the, regardless of what your strategy is, this is the amount of capability you can provide at those prices. The next question you have to ask is, well, is that adequate for the strategy that you've adopted? And I think people, when they look at a 2021 system, 2021 force structure, are going to be pretty shocked at how little capacity that's in there, because we've gotten so used to spending dollars for this. And there's going to have to be a ratcheting back of strategic appetite or expansionist goals, aspirations. So the answer is yes.
It's pretty clear historically that we gain a lot from forward presence, but we don't really know how to modulate foreign presence to the most cost-effective measure. It's also pretty clear from history that we tend to size our force structure and our capability on the assumption that everything we do, we're going to do by ourselves. So I think that there's three premiums that come into the yes question there. One is, how do you define the essential parts of foreign presence that are worth sustaining, where, in fact, you'd save so little money compared to the loss of capability that it just doesn't make any sense? The second is, how do you create an integrated interoperability is actually too soft a word. It's really an integrated capability with partners and allies to where you get much more, the whole is much more than the sum of the parts. For example, you could actually look at real requirements for foreign military sales rather than targets of opportunity and what helps the bottom line for somebody. And you could actually change the way in which we do export controls and interoperability so that with some of our best allies and partners, we're actually operating the same platforms. We would even take a downgrade in terms of capability on the per platform level in order to gain capability at the combined efforts level. And the third is, you got to recognize that there's a basic disconnect between inexpensive forward presence operations and what the services will protect in their FITIPs, because that's not a big deal to them. So it needs to change the equation in terms of how we validate and evaluate that internally. There's a lot of opportunity there to do more with less money, but it requires a lot of changes in the way we both define requirements and allocate resources and conduct shaping and engagement operations. So let me pick up a couple from the web, one for Marin, and these are interesting questions. They're actually statements, and the question is, what do you think about that? which most of you have not gone into, but I think it's kind of the statement is that protecting OCO only really means setting O&M priorities overall, and that's normal in drawdowns. A 10% cut in O&M resources may lead to the priority being put on reducing contracted for services and doing furloughing for civilians. Not pretty, but manageable. Do you agree?
I think the aggregate answer is yes. The O&M accounts have both the curse and the advantage of being very flexible. Again, I think some of the question is how much flexibility will they really have if you have to spend your maintenance money to ensure the workload at the depots, if you have to there are a number of mandated, legislatively mandated requirements. You have to have sexual assault response coordinators for every 100 people, and a huge number of required O&M funded things for any number of different things, all of which are important, but which you have little latitude. So there's a lot of, I think, underestimation of the degrees of freedom that there are both in statute and in policy and to some degree in regulation. I think fundamentally, yes, but it isn't pretty, and it can be sub-optimized, particularly if you have to do it fast.
One more?
Yeah.
I've got one in the back here, and then I think we'll probably call it quits at that point. Although we're happy to stay and have conversations with folks.
I'm Howie Lynn from Floor. How about just looking into the next administration or the new administration, new leadership positions, a new either Defense Secretary, Secretary of State, or other OMB directors, or any other positions of key leadership in the new administration? How would, if any, effect on anything you've said today?
I think it'll have an enormous effect. You'd think we'd be getting pretty experienced at second terms of administrations. This is going to be the fourth one we've done in the last 30 years. And yet the degrees of uncertainty and the difficulties of the timetable, because you're not in a hurry. When you've won your second term, you don't have this January 20th noon deadline that everybody's got to be gone and the new team's got to be in place. For years we've been saying the next Secretary of Defense is going to have a much harder time than the previous one, and this time it might actually be true that it will be. And one of the remarkable things that Secretary Panetta has done, and it's remarkable at least from a PR perspective or a public visibility perspective, is a magnitude of reductions in the hundreds of billions of dollars with no visible revolution internally. Nobody complaining publicly. Now, you could say, obviously, that means they didn't cut enough yet because they would be complaining otherwise. But there is a value to DOD of uniformity and unanimity in agreement on these internal reductions. And that falls largely on the Secretary to both create the dynamic in which that agreement can occur and to sustain and enforce it publicly and privately going forward. It's going to be a tough call for the next Secretary. My understanding is... Leon Panetta has said something to the effect of, I intend to stick around to see this budget deal through. Now, I don't know if he's thought through fully what the chronological implications of that statement are. He may have just meant until we get to January 2nd and we see whether there's a sequestration order or not, because I think my timeline of that is 15 months before we see where this budget deal goes. So it's probably somewhere in between there. But obviously the leadership changes at the political appointee and Senate-confirmed level have a very, very powerful impact on this. In defense, there's always been a premium on merit and competence as a requirement for political appointments. I don't expect that to change. I think that's still going to continue to be the case. Of course, everybody has feet of clay also, so we always see their shortcomings. But I think that's still going to be true for defense going forward. Do you have any other comments on that?
I think for anything to work requires a very strong Secretary of Defense who's willing to make tough decisions and willing to hold people accountable. I think Bob Gates set a very high bar that's rarely been matched in practice by any Secretary of Defense. And I say this with considerable regret because I was the chief policy aide to Les Aspin, who was the chairman of the Armed Services Committee. One of my unspoken jobs, I had three tasks at that time: engage Republicans in a debate on national security issues, inoculate a Democratic candidate against soft on defense charges. And we opted out of the one campaign pretty quickly and did a lot of services for Clinton during the next one. But Dukakis and that tank, you know, just beyond repair on the soft on defense. And the third unwritten thing is to get our guy Secretary of Defense. And we did that. We had a good run in the House of Representatives. He turned out, I say regretfully, to be a disaster as Secretary of Defense. You never know what's going to happen when somebody actually becomes the Secretary of Defense, one of the toughest jobs around, because it has both Paul Mill aspects and huge resource implications, and it's a huge management challenge. Panetta is an extremely, you know, he's a grand master at the art of budgetary politics. That doesn't mean he can manage the Department of Defense.
You could argue that anybody who wants the job clearly doesn't understand how hard it is and should therefore be automatically disqualified from service. That's not the case, obviously, but it is going to be a tough challenge. And it is one of the things which we clearly have to watch going forward, because an awful lot of burden is going to fall to the current secretary and to the next one as well. So with that, and luckily America historically has found those people, and they have stepped up, and we have gotten awfully good service from our Secretary of Defense over the years, and we're going to need it for the next one as well. So thank you all for joining us. Thank you on the web, and we'll adjourn for the day.